I'm Faith Middleton, and this show is about the richness of life. Thanks for listening in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New York, including the East End of Long Island. Sculptor Marianne Weil lives in Orient on the East End of Long Island, where she has a studio. She works sometimes furiously fast because of the oppositional forces of the material she uses, creating pieces that are fusions of glass and bronze. After touring her workshop, I could not believe how difficult it can be to control the melting bronze and melting glass, urging them to bow to her instincts, to harden together into sculptural shapes that reference ancient forms and yet have a modernist sensual line. It's quite a process, as you're about to hear. Marianne Weil is represented by Kouros Gallery in New York City and Kouros Sculpture Center in Ridgefield, Connecticut. She is assistant professor of sculpture at CUNY's College of Staten Island. Welcome to the show, Marianne.
Thank you so much, Faith. It's a pleasure to be with you and discuss my work with you.
So we have to do this. Of course, we're going to tell people how to see your work online. And some people will do that. In fact, I'll tell them right now. They can follow along. Go to marianneweil.com, MarianneWeil.com. You work in glass and bronze. They seem oppositional to me. Is that fair?
They are, in fact, and that makes it both challenging and liberating for me to work with materials that contrast. They create both a primal tension between the density of the bronze and the lightness of the glass. So I'm exploring a lot of nuances between the solidity and transparency of both materials.
Now, did it start out with one material? And then did you find yourself saying, what would happen if?
Yes. I've been working with bronze for over 30 years. And around the time I started to seriously get involved with bronze, I was doing an installation in glass using glass panes and was fascinated by the interaction between the metal and the glass. I ended up pursuing a path of being a bronze sculptor for all these years, and several years ago received a grant to research and explore combining and fusing the two materials, which was a wonderful incentive to go down this path.
I think we'll hear how complex this is if we look at these materials one at a time. When you are working with just bronze, how do you shape it? How does it melt so that it's formable?
Well, I use the traditional process of lost wax casting, which means I work directly with a wax before it's cast in bronze. Some sculptors may create a piece in clay or stone first and then make a mold, but ultimately a sculptor needs to have a wax to achieve a bronze sculpture. So I skip the steps of making a mold and work directly in wax. I build my sculptures up about a quarter of an inch thick with wax sheets. And in my studio, I use soldering irons, hot tools over an open flame. I melt wax, and with softened wax, I can tool it and form the various shapes and textures of my work.
So I'm right now in a catalog of yours from a show looking at a piece called Mindful, mm-hmm. and it's cast bronze and blown glass. It's about 11 inches by 7 inches by 3 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I would describe this is that we have a piece of textured bronze, and inside it there is a piece of amber glass that looks as if it's pouring out of the bronze, and there's a little hole in a part of the bronze, and it's peeking out of that hole too. So we have an overlapped bronze cone that's textured like a waffle cone from an ice cream cone kind of a thing, but very sensual in its feeling, and inside the glass just seeping out in also in a sensual way. Now, let's say you made this bronze piece the way you just described it, by using the wax mold.
Yeah, the bronze and glass sculpture, Mindful, was first created. The bronze piece is armor-like in sensibility. It has an industrial texture that I've incorporated into the wax surface. So I cast the bronze piece first, and then separately in a completely different period, then worked in the glass studio to blow the glass into the vessel, the bronze vessel. So I created a number of bronze sculptures that were vessel-like that could hold the blown glass. And the extruded glass that comes out sort of like a nose is forced out of that small area. So I designed the sculptures, the bronze pieces, to create that pressure or that tension for the glass also.
This is Marianne Weil. She is a sculptor in glass and bronze whose work has been featured in shows around the world. She lives on the east end of Long Island in Orient and is represented by Kouros Sculpture Center in Ridgefield, Connecticut, and their gallery in New York City. And you can see examples of her work online now as we speak or later on at marianneweil.com. That's W-E-I-L.com. Where are you right now? What part of the house are you in?
My living room, right outside my studio.
Are you on a walkable phone? Can you
I
walk?
Am.
Would you walk into your studio for me?
Certainly. I'm here.
Oh, so you're right close by. Okay. This process we just described where you're blowing this amber-colored glass into this piece of bronze that is a vessel. What are you looking at around you? What tools are you using? Do you have one of those long instruments for blowing the glass?
Well, I don't blow the glass at my studio. One needs a glory hole, a furnace, an annealing oven. So at my studio, I have a number of items to do finishing work in bronze, to build the wax sculptures, and I also have a kiln to do kiln cast glass. So that's very different than blown glass. Sculptors need a variety of equipment and tools, and in my case, various kinds of furnaces also to do their work.
Yeah, I hear that. So let's say you would bring into that studio you're in now at home the vessel and the glass that you'd blown someplace else.
Correct. Or I'm working on a number of pieces right now, constructing copper and bronze components that would be the basis of the interiors of some of the blown forms that I've been working on. So it takes quite a bit of planning with various materials in mixed media, let's say, copper and bronze.
If I look at this piece of glass on this Mindful piece, and I see that it's inside the bronze vessel, and it looks like it's pouring out and it's in movement. It looks very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
What tools do you have right there as you're standing in your studio that you would have used to put that glass inside that bronze vessel?
Right here, I don't. I would have to go to a glass blowing studio for that particular piece.
Because it would have to be melty.
Yes, and one needs a glory hole to blow the glass, a large furnace that where you gather the glass on a blowpipe, mm-hmm. a glass blowpipe, and then from the blown vessel, then it goes into an annealing oven where it's tempered. The glass is tempered over a number of days.
What does that mean?
Tempered is allowing the glass to cool slowly. If glass is cooled too quickly, it will fracture and one could lose their sculpture.
Are you comfortable? Have you been made to be comfortable not knowing exactly how something's going to turn out?
Well, that's the beauty of this new departure for me. It's a relatively new material, combining both these both glass and bronze. And being that they're extremely different, the unexpected in this quest to discover is what truly inspires me.
I know that you have spent a fair amount of time traveling the world and looking at ancient forms. And I'm always fascinated when I'm exposed to them in museums or in the field. And there seems to be a kind of eternal interest in certain textures, shapes, forms that surprises me. Do you have that sense?
Yes, that's very true. I draw a great deal of inspiration from archaeology, and for a number of years have visited Neolithic sites from Ireland and Scotland, Maltese temples, and in southern Spain. And just the years of climbing through tombs and caverns and crawling around in megalithic passage graves and touching the motifs, the wall engravings have inspired my work consciously and unconsciously. There's also the archaeology of the urban industrial life that is reflected in some of the materials that I use and incorporate in the works.
Let's talk about the tension between the conscious and the unconscious. You go out into the field, you go to one of these sites, say in Spain, and you see things, and you're putting these slides into your visual memory.
Right.
And you come back, and is it the case that sometimes you say, I know that I'm referencing what I just saw? And then there are other times when you make something and say, oh, well, look at that. You know, I didn't realize it, but I'm referencing what I just saw.
It's frequently the second scenario that you described. Work filters in very odd ways into my work, and over years of pursuing and developing new sculptures, sometimes 10 years later, I say, aha, I have an aha moment. It was because I was doing such and such 10 years before that. And that's what's really terrific about the discipline of continually having the opportunity to be in the studio to rediscover these moments and these experiences in one's work. So, yeah, the inspiration is reflected in so many different times in the work. And sometimes they're trapped in our unconscious and then unfold suddenly.
I see a duality through your work with each piece. On the one hand, it's very rooted and grounded. And on the other hand, there's a sensuality about it. And then there's the duality of the materials themselves, the glass versus the bronze. What do you think about that kind of duality? Do you think much about it?
Well, I am now. I think I've created these works that are the processes, and each of the pieces combining materials is so complex, it's almost like orchestrating a musical work. You know, the many different components that compose the entire whole are constantly at work. So I'm playing with that, and that's what's fun about the work, too.
This is glass and bronze sculptor Marianne Weil, who lives in Orient on the east end of Long Island, is represented by the Kouros Gallery in New York City and also by the Sculpture Center in Ridgefield, Connecticut, the Kouros Sculpture Center. When do you know? Right now I see that you're exploring this, and I know you're going to be going to the Corning Center as a kind of fellow to explore. They don't invite many people to do that there at Corning Glass, and I know you're going, and that's going to be exciting for you to explore some new things. When do you know that it's time to move on? It's time to push something in yet a newer direction, to keep growing as you see and become richer within yourself and want to express that in the work. How do you know?
That's a very difficult question. Sometimes when you find yourself repeating a motif, sometimes that motif can be compelling enough to repeat it for years. But I think personally, when I'm no longer challenged or intrigued by the work, that I'm not surprised, I find that I need to take risks with the work. And if I'm no longer doing that, then I look to pursue other avenues.
There's a painter, I think it's John Hodgkins, he's my favorite painter. Sometimes a canvas of his, often they're on wood, will take 20 years. I've worked on one for 20 years. He just keeps coming back to different ones at different times and adding layers. Does that happen to you too?
In fact, the piece that you mentioned earlier, Mindful, was a piece that was cast several years ago and then developed as a combined glass and bronze piece. That frequently happens now with combining bronze and glass, because bronze is so labor intensive, it can take 6 months to a year to complete a series in bronze. So I'll be digesting the work and thinking about how I'll incorporate it with the glass. But yes, that happens more and more with the work, as one has work around to ponder and consider how it might play into new work, that happens more frequently.
I see that the bronze in this final minute we have, of course, as a metal like this is, it can have textures and streaks. But in the glass, I see sometimes that your glass being blown into the bronze has these color streaks in it. And I love that. Do you like that also?
Yes, thank you. I've developed some combinations, a rapport between the bronze and the glass. I take pride in knowing how to do my patinas on the bronze, so I've applied that love into the glass pieces, where I'll use sand and pigments and different powdered pigments from copper shavings or bronze shavings to color the glass.
Wow.
And so they have a relationship in that respect as well.
Well, how lucky your students must be to learn how to do something like this from you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great to talk to you. Hope we get to talk again.
Oh, thank you, Faith. It's been a true pleasure to discuss and introduce my work to your audience.
Marianne Weil, sculptor in glass and bronze, whose work has been featured in shows worldwide. She lives on the east end of Long Island in Orient. It's represented by Coro Sculpture Center in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And you can see examples of her work online at MarianneWeil.com. Just ahead, the practicing mind, how to be in the moment. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks so much for listening. Online worldwide at WNPR.org. Type in the keyword faith, F-A-I-T-H. Contrary to popular belief, it's not always innate talent that makes someone stand out in a chosen field. It's actually the number of hours that are invested in achieving the success. In fact, research has shown that it takes 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to reach true mastery of any skill, whether we're playing a musical instrument, excelling at a sport, learning a new language, or even creating a successful business. Well, this book, The Practicing Mind, Developing Focus and Discipline in Your Life, offers practical advice for making the most out of the practicing process. Author Thomas Stirner, prompted by his experiences learning to play golf as an adult and as an accomplished musician, reintroduces us to a process we followed to acquire new skills before we knew what process meant. He also reminds us that life is a journey that requires and even forces us, either consciously or unconsciously, to master one skill after another. Stirner explains that rediscovering the state of mind is a skill in and of itself that comes down to a few simple rules. We're going to get to those. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Faith. It's great to be here.
I understand that you felt pretty incapable of accomplishing goals and tasks that you set for yourself. And then there was a turning point. What was it?
The turning point, which I didn't recognize at first, began when I graduated from high school and I was into college, and someone introduced me to a Religions of the World course, which I became very infatuated with, and I studied all the different Eastern thought systems, which focused a lot of attention on the process and being in the moment as opposed to being product-oriented. And then several years later, I got into golf and was again fascinated by the modern performance sports psychologies that are being used all over, and they've become very refined over the last 25 years. And I saw that they were saying the same thing about how we learn when we're functioning at our highest level with the least amount of stress and the highest productivity. And so I began to look at that, and I also noticed that in my mid-20s, I was constantly being referred to by people around me that as one of the most disciplined people that they knew. Hmm. So I knew that I didn't start out that way, and I began trying to just write all this down and figure out how I got from one place to another.
We often have a psychologist on the air who practices in New Haven, Dr. Nancy Horn, and she's remarkable. And she said once in an interview that what happens is that there is a block that pops up that it is just common in any process of trying to do something. And that block, instead of people figuring out how to get around it or leap over it or ignore it, stops people's energy right in their tracks. And so they give up on the project. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yes, it does sound familiar. And I think that a lot of the block comes from a misuse of the goal. In other words, when we set a goal, whatever that is, whether it's learning a musical instrument or losing 30 pounds, what we immediately do, we perceive this as when we get to this goal, we're going to be happy. We're all walking around with a feeling of incomplete, and That we are incomplete, and we're always looking to satisfy that feeling and get rid of it. And I think that when we set these goals for ourselves, we think, when I step on the scale and it says 30 pounds are gone, in that moment I'm going to be happy. And when we do that, the very first thing that we have just done is made the process of getting from here to there almost our enemy. We have to struggle through it. We have to endure it. It's this nuisance that we have to go through so that we can just get to this place out here where we're going to find happiness. And I think that's where we really make a wrong turn.
It's confusing because there are experts, so-called experts out there, who say keep your eyes on the prize. In other words, you know, that shining thing at the end of the road that you're trying to get to. Just keep that in your mind. And you're saying something quite the opposite, which is you know what's down there, but keep your focus on this moment. So if we looked at, say, Tiger Woods, he'd be saying, if he's way behind in a game, this hole that I'm on right now is the important hole.
Absolutely. In fact, that's a repeated mantra all the time. It's so basic in modern competitive golf that no one would even think of having the conversation. When Luke Donald from England became the number one player, I saw him in a tournament being interviewed, and it was the beginning of the tournament, and he was, if he won that tournament, he was going to become the number one golfer in the world for the first time in his life. And they said, you know, what do you think about if you win this tournament, you'll become the number one golfer in the world? And he said, what has gotten me to this place where I have that opportunity has been being in the moment of each hole that I have played so far this year, being in the moment of each stroke, each putt, everything I've done, I have to be in the moment of. And he said, if I start focusing on being number one, he said, which is where I would like to end up, he said, then I will lose my focus on the moment and I won't achieve it.
This is Thomas M. Sterner. He's author of the book, The Practicing Mind, and it's about how to develop focus and discipline to master any skill or challenge. And you do so by knowing that you have a goal, but then in a way ignoring it and staying just in the moment you're in. How do you do that?
Well, to back up a little bit, I wouldn't say that you ignore the goal. I would say that you recognize the goal and use it as a rudder. The first thing you have to do is to become aware that you want to be in the moment. I mean, most people aren't even thinking about that. They're just going through their day, and they're not even thinking about the value of being in the present moment. The next thing is that you have to become aware of your thoughts, because if you're not aware of your thoughts, then you're not aware when you're in the moment, what that feels like, and when you're not in the moment and what that feels like. And one of the first things that I ask people to do when I work with them is to sit in a chair, not in front of me, but when they go home, to sit in a chair for 10 minutes and close their eyes and stop thinking. And what they find out immediately is that they can't do it. And it may be the first time in their life where they recognize or they experience the fact that their mind produces thoughts all day long, and it does it with or without their permission. And if they can learn that in that moment there where they have that awareness that my mind produces thoughts, and sometimes those thoughts are pulling me here and there in the future and the past and all these different places, in order for me to stop that, I have to be aware of when that's happening. So then they begin a process of what we can call, you can call it meditation if you don't like the label of it, then you can call it thought awareness management, you know, where you just start to begin to be aware of where your mind is in relationship to where you are right now and what you're doing.
And so that would sound like you're trying to accomplish something in this moment. All these thoughts are zinging across your mind. You would say what to yourself? Oh, that's interesting. Look what my mind is thinking about right now.
Yes, and what you have to realize is it's just in that moment, what you just said, oh, my mind is zinging around. Right in that moment, what you have changed is the fact that you have just noticed it. And when you've just noticed it, that's when you begin to expand that ability, if you want to call it an exercise or repetition. But just in that very second when you do that is when you notice that your mind is going someplace that you don't want it to go. And the reason that that's of value is that you understand that it's the repetitive action of doing that. It's easiest when you first start out to do it in a thing like a 10-minute meditation, because you're not trying to do anything else. It's difficult to do it, like, say, when you're working on a report at work, because you have a lot of other distractions, and because it's a new skill that you're starting out with, you don't want to put yourself in a worst-case scenario right off the bat. So when you take this time and you sit down for a few minutes and you try to do it, you begin to experience what it feels like when you are doing it. And as you do that, you know, it doesn't take very much, 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the afternoon. You begin to experience that, and then this awareness starts to grow in you, and you begin to see when you're in the present moment and when you're not in the present moment.
Another way of labeling that is being in the flow. People talk about this all the time. I certainly have experienced this so many times in my life. I am so in the moment. I am so in the experience with another person or the project that I lose track of time completely.
That's true. And the paradox is that when you're in the moment, you're not aware that you're in the moment because you're in the moment. It's like they say in meditation, you know, you're trying to stop thinking. When you start to experience not thinking and you go, hey, I'm actually not thinking, well, you just started thinking again, you know. So it's when you're in the moment, you're right, you're really not aware, and time, your perception of time changes drastically.
What about fear? If people are trying new tasks, there's often fear attached to that because some people have been taught that they might fail. Others just feel uncomfortable because something new just feels automatically challenging. That's almost part of the human condition. And so all of that is distracting in a way. How do you counteract that?
That's a really great point. And I think that we can kind of refer back to the thought awareness, because fear starts with the thought. As you just described, people have this interpretation, either it's through something they've been handed or something they've read or some impression that they have of themselves. And for me, and when I was younger, I did experience a fear. It wasn't a fear for my life, but when I was trying to do something new, I always had this fear that I wouldn't see it through. And, of course, I lived that out. And when you begin to realize that the fear is a thought, well, one of the things that we can do is you can create triggers. You work on a procedure, and this is, you can look at all the things like pilots, like Captain Sully landing on the Hudson River. You know, there's a situation that was very fearful, but how is it handled? Well, in a quiet time, pilots learn all these procedures, and the reason for the procedures is so that they can disconnect themselves from the fear thought that starts the panic and that starts that whole mind agitation and internal dialogue that starts. So one of the things that I work with people on is to try to come up with a procedure for types of situations like you're describing, where they begin to feel a fearful thought, I might not be able to get this done. If you can then use the trigger, but once again, you have to get back to where you have to recognize, oh, I'm having a fearful thought. If you're just in the thought and you have the fearful thought, then you just experience the fear.
What you're describing is two different things. One is emotion, fear, and the other one is using your intellect to tap fear on the shoulder and say, I'm not going to be paying attention to you. Does it work?
Yes, it does work. Absolutely. That's the reason why, and landing the airplane on the Hudson is an extreme situation where that is about everything that could have gone wrong there went wrong. And it would have been very easy for him to, in the initial bird strike where the engines quit, for him to say, you know, oh, geez, I got a plane full of fuel. I got a plane full of people. I'm over in New York City. There's no place to land. And all this fear and dialogue that starts inside. And instead, what he did was he latched onto this procedure that he had learned. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Intellect.
Right. He's in the intellect now, and that's when he separated himself, and his emotions are not in control of what he's doing. At that point, he's a conscious choice maker, and he has the ability to make the choices because he's aware, I don't want to go there, and I don't want to let those thoughts flow because they're not going to serve me very well in this situation.
So the book is about understanding the end result, where you want to go, but on the other hand, learning to love, training yourself to love the practice, the process of getting there. It's all about staying in the moment, as we have heard all of our lives. And my guest says it's absolutely true, and it's how he overcame the sense that he wasn't ever going to finish any tasks and went on to learn many, many of them. Thank you so much.
It was great to be here.
Thomas Stirner is author of Practicing Mind in Paperback.
Next, how do we make a better America? This is the conversation everybody wants to have right now.
I'm Faith Middleton. Can't thank you enough for listening. This is what we're thinking about now, and it's the title of this book, How Transformative Change Can Come to America. We know where we stand. We face challenges, joblessness, failing schools, declining health,
serious poverty, income inequality, an environment that is a mess. We have dwindling natural resources. There's indebtedness. We have climate change. We have war. You know, on the other hand, we have the highest GDP in the world, gross domestic product, the highest in the world. Yet when you look at our scores, how is it that we have that? But we're also scoring so poorly on many measures of well-being. The infant mortality rate is higher than that of nations like ours. Our students don't compare well. We work more, yet we keep hearing we're less satisfied. And one in six of us is truly poor. How do we tackle this? Well, we think start a conversation about it. And so we have turned to our guest, James Gustav Speth. He is a former professor and dean at the Environmental and Forestry School at Yale University. He is author of America the Possible, Manifesto for a New Economy. And in this book, he outlines the sweeping changes that he feels we must embrace now to leave our children a prosperous, secure, healthy, and satisfying America. Now, the changes that he calls for are not incremental. He demands that we reconsider a lot of assumptions that we hold, starting with the idea that economic growth is always good. And he charts a new and different course for our country. Gus Speth is with us by phone. Welcome to the show. Welcome back, I should say.
Hi, Faith. It's great to be back with you. I wish I were there in person.
I wish you were. But I know you're across the country, so that's not going to work. When I read that list at the beginning of all the things that are wrong.
Yeah, 30 dimensions. We were at the bottom of the well-to-do countries.
Yeah, I thought, oh, no, people are probably racing to the dial or the button to shut us off as fast as they can, because nobody wants anything more than to be better. And so, you know, sometimes I think we should tackle things, as you have in the book, to talk about, all right, we know what our problems are. Let's get to it. So how did you walk that line between saying, spending time on what's wrong and time on what we need to do? Do you feel an urgency about this?
Well, I have these six lovely grandchildren, which are motivating me tremendously as I enter my 70s. There's a stark juxtaposition in the book because I begin in part one by sort of outlining the problems that their country faces environmentally, socially, politically, economically. And it is a daunting list of challenges that where, as I said, we, you know, in a 20-country sample of the advanced democracies, we're at the bottom on 30 critical indicators. And so what I do is I juxtapose that problem with a future that we could have by 2050 if we were really serious about getting there, the kind of future we actually would want to leave to our children and grandchildren.
You also raise this question of how change happens. Things have become so narrow cast in terms of media, information. There aren't singular sources anymore where everybody's on the same page. And so You don't see the kinds of massive demonstrations on streets you used to see calling for a particular change. You see things, people calling for things on the internet. I wonder how powerful that is. Well, I guess you could say it elected a president.
I think I'm in Madison. They are still excited here in Madison about the hundreds of thousands of people that came out and circled the State House and supported the public sector unions.
So you mean Madison, Wisconsin,
Madison,
we should say.
Madison, Wisconsin, yes. You mentioned this, you know, what could drive real deep change in our country?
Yeah, what's your theory of change?
Well, I have some thoughts on that, and let me share them with you quickly. I mean, first, we have to see that what we have is a systemic problem. What we have is a system failure. When you have problems across this whole front of issues that you mentioned, you know, it's not for small reasons. It's because we got the system is failing us, and we need to build a new system of political economy, basically. We need to reprogram this country's operating system, and that's a big challenge, but we've got to see that as the problem. Secondly, we've got to be prepared to act on crises. They are going to come, but we weren't prepared in 2008, really, when the financial crisis hit, and we, you know, that can drive real change if we are prepared. The third thing is that the progressives have got to come together. We have siloed and separated the different progressive communities, and they don't really work together in a coordinated way with a singleness of purpose, and that's important. we have to have a positive vision of the future. I mentioned this, you know, my effort in the book to describe what 2050 could be like if we were serious. But we need a lot more work on the making the future come alive in our minds. And then we need to start building that future locally. You know, Washington will be the last to see it, probably. But in our communities and localities and neighborhoods around the country, you know, we're seeing people really invest in change. And sometimes it's mandatory, as in Detroit, where they're having to reinvent the city. But this local change is very important. We need transformative leadership. We need a new story, a new narrative, and a transformative leadership, which we hoped Obama was going to be, and maybe he will be now, and not just transactional leadership.
How important is the local change that you talk about? Is it the most important?
Well, I think it's the most hopeful thing happening right now. You know, we're seeing the birth of transition towns, of we're seeing a co-op movement, a local banking movement, you know, move your money movement. We're seeing a lot of localities passing resolutions calling for, you know, changing the Constitution to reverse the Citizens United decision.
And look at what happened in California, where the voters said, yes, we want to put money into education and we're willing to pay for it.
Amazing. No, it's there was some impressive things happening in this last election, obviously, and you know, I'm here in Wisconsin talking to you, and Tammy Baldwin was elected to the Senate, and big, you know, surprised. And a lot of important things happened, and a lot of things are happening at the grassroots around the country. But one of the things we need to build is a real movement, a grassroots movement in the country. We have isolated campaigns, and we have isolated groups organizing, but the progressives have got to come together, and Washington will never respond unless there's pressure from the outside.
So how does that happen, and where does it begin?
Well, and one thing that's happening, you know, in some places, is that there are these local progressive councils being formed, and they meet regularly, and they cross-cut, and they bring, you know, in local areas, they bring cross-section of community interest and progressive causes together. I think that's very important. The national groups have to invest a lot more in local grassroots organizing. I mean, my environmental tribe, you know, where I worked for all my life, is really lost touch in a lot of ways with the national groups, with building a grassroots movement and getting into politics and becoming political. Environmentalists have got to get into political life in a much bigger way than they are now. And I think people are going to have to be willing to, you know, to protest and to demonstrate and to march. And I spent 3 days in the central cell block of the D.C. jail protesting the proposal to construct this Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. And, that was a small thing for me, but it had some effect because enough people joined with us, and eventually, you know, we encircled the White House twice with demonstrators, and at least postponed it. We don't know what's going to happen in the long run, but I think that you know, the demonstrations here in Madison, Wisconsin, have been had a very big effect and mobilizing folks here, and I think that's what it's going to take. You know, a rebirth of some things we saw in the 60s and 70s.
Gus, I don't know if you're aware of, I know you're aware of what the hurricane did to New Jersey, New York, and parts of Connecticut and other places, too. I know you're aware of that. But I'm not sure you're aware that what I learned last night, and that is that in some of the most devastated areas, say on Staten Island, do you know who is really coordinating efforts the most?
Occupy. They're
Occupy. Exactly.
Absolutely.
They learn so much about how to function without a home, how to power your own electricity, how to organize food, that all these people have been left homeless and on the street and are freezing cold. The Occupy people headed right there and started organizing for these storm victims.
It was very moving, and it was so gratifying to read about that, and it's so terrible to see the photographs and the footage from these areas that are still severely impacted. We had a big dose of that. I live in Vermont, as you know, and we had a big dose of that with Hurricane Irene, over a year ago. But this is very serious and much more populated. But I think Occupy has been already accomplished an amazing change. When I started research for the book and was pulling together all the data about where the country really stands, you know, there wasn't much discussion of inequality or 1% or poverty or desperation in the country or job. You know, there was discussion of joblessness, of course. But and Occupy really put those issues on the map.
But don't you think there is something to the notion that was discussed that Occupy, if they'd had a little bit more focus, could have lasted longer and made even greater change happen? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it takes all types, honestly. We need different sort of branches of a movement. A lot of the Occupy people wanted to change people's way of thinking, people's way of seeing the world, and they didn't want to get into politics, and they were sort of rejecting of the whole political system. And I think that there's a place for that. There's also a place for doing what the Tea Party did, and that is to move from protest to movement to power, to into electoral politics quickly. And the Tea Party shows that you can do that in the United States if you're serious and mobilized and organized, at least locally, to do it. And so I'm hoping that progressives will, you know, take a page from what the Tea Party did, will continue to strengthen and build on what Occupy did, and people who want to, you know, change your mind and change our way of thinking, you know, by raising issues and demonstrating the seriousness of them, that's good. People who want to get into politics, we need that too. We need to build a political movement as well.
I want to talk with you about how we look at things and how conversations get shaped. You mentioned Occupy Wall Street is starting the whole conversation about the 1%. And so I we'll get to that on the other side of this identification. I'm talking with former Yale Dean at the Environmental Policy School, Gus Speth. He's author of a new book called How Transformative Change Can Come to America. If you look at one area, healthcare, I think why isn't healthcare being discussed as equal in value to the defense budget? Why do we see healthcare as almost an entitlement, whereas the defense budget is necessary? We're going to shape it and make cuts to it, but you can't go too far because it's vital to our survival and quality of life here. And yet we don't think about health as personal security. When we think of the defense budget as national security, why isn't there equal value for personal security?
Well, there should be. And in the book, I discuss this, this severe imbalance that we have in our international spending, favoring the military and security rather than trying to deal with the unconventional threats to security internationally and internationally. And we also have a healthcare system, as you point out, that is we spend more on it than any other of the 20 advanced countries as a percentage of GDP, and we get the worst results. We have the highest infant mortality, the greatest obesity, the highest levels of mental health problems, the shortest life expectancy, and on and on. So we're clearly mismanaging the resource that we have for healthcare, and at the same time we are spending 2/3 of the discretionary spending of our federal government on security now, we have a military that is. Almost half the world's total military spending is in the U.S. Meanwhile, big threats to security like climate change are coming hard at us, and we're largely ignoring it. So there's a real problem in our priorities in Washington, and I think a lot of people see that now. And so the question is, what do we need to do about it? And I think we need to walk on two legs. In effect, we need to address some of the urgent things with the government we've got. There's no choice. Climate change, joblessness, healthcare improvements.
But here's what I wonder, Gus. How do we compete with the big money lobbyists in Washington who are right there and just grab these legislators and take them into the hallway and say, you know, we're willing to make some contributions. And, I mean, there's money everywhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of speculation, you know, a lot of, I think, happiness today that the big money didn't carry the election and didn't have the impact that was feared to have. But we have to remember something. The corporations spend, you know, maybe 10 times as much on lobbying after the elections than they do on campaign expenditures. So, you know, the problem of this, you know, corporate control, really, of our you know, political outcomes will persist, even though the big money didn't really have the impact that we feared in the elections. So, you know, how do we deal with that? Well, you know, first, you know, there's in my book, America the Possible, which you've kindly mentioned, I have an agenda of political reforms that we need to undertake. And you know, one of those is a series of reforms of the lobbying process to make it more transparent, to do what Connecticut has done, and outlaw lobbyists bundling contributions to campaigns, you know, outlawing in effect this pay-to-play system in Washington. There's a lot we can do to close the revolving door between government and outside of government, you know, we can expand the definition of lobbying, make it more transparent. So there's just a lot we can do, and we need to reform our, you know, system of financing elections also.
Yeah, you're talking in Connecticut about the ban on registered lobbyists engaging in campaign fundraising.
Yes.
Yeah, and you're saying this could work.
We need it nationally.
Yeah. What about public financing of campaigns?
Well, this ought to be a major cause right now in the wake of this election. I mean, you know, the money didn't prove as important as Karl Rove expected it to be. It's not unimportant, that's for sure, and it's not going to go away. So we need to do two things, I think. Basically, there's a movement in the country to amend the Constitution, and it's got real strength. And there are hundreds of groups across the country that are proposing that, and states are joining in the fight. And I think this, amending the Constitution is always a long shot, but a hard row. But I think there's a chance for this. The other thing we need to do is to put in place, a combination of small donor and federal matching financing for the elections. Make it high enough money there so that candidates can opt into the system and still win. And I think there are states that have this fair elections now law in place, and others that are taking it up. And we should do it at the federal level. And there, of course, there is legislation that has been introduced by Senator Durbin of Illinois and others to have this fair elections approach, both in the congressional races and in the presidential election. So, you know, I don't think under the current Supreme Court and their interpretation of the Constitution, it's going to be hard to take big money out of politics. But we can have an alternative path which undermines that. And so I think those are, you know, two different ways to go, to amend the Constitution and maybe amend the Supreme Court if we get some appointments. Just one vote could help, just swaying this line of decisions the other way, and to put this Fair Elections Now legislation to move it forward. In the wake of this election, we really need to get serious about political reform.
You talk in the book about how to measure community progress. You can keep track of it. You talk in the book about reforming media. You talk about climate change and what we can do. The list goes on and on. It's very, very interesting, and you quote some fascinating people in this book, and I think this is the conversation everybody wants to have right now. We're going to continue it on the show. As you know, we're inviting you back to talk about this. Gus, thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thank you, and thank you for introducing America the Possible to your audience.
James Gus Speth. His book is called America the Possible, and it's about manifesto for a new economy. Thanks also to our senior producer, Lori Mack, and producer, Jonathan McNichol. In New Haven, I'm Faith Middleton.